Good morning, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. Thank you, members who are here, for being on time. And we're going to go ahead and get started. We're waiting for a couple of our members, but we do have witnesses who have delayed trips in order to be here, and we don't want to keep them longer than we have to. So this is an informational meeting about various topics to do with jobs and the economy. And the first one we've entitled The Path Back to Lower Unemployment. We have with us Graham Slater, who is an administrator from the Workforce and Economic Research Division of the Employment Department. So we really appreciate you being here, since we know you were supposed to be out of state at a conference and delayed your trip to be with us today. So thank you very much for doing that. Good morning.
You're very welcome, Madam Chair, and thanks for the introduction. Members of the committee, it's good to be with you. And thanks for the chance to just update you on this very severe recession that you're all very well aware of, and also just some of the latest numbers and the forecasts as we see them for the short and long-term future here for Oregon's employment. For the record, my name is Graham Slater, and I am the administrator of the Workforce and Economic Research Division in the Oregon Employment Department. The title for this morning's presentation was actually chosen by your committee administrator or your chair or one of those people, The Path Back to Lower Unemployment, and that makes it sound oh so simple. And so I added the subtitle, which was Dreaming of the Day When Dismal Data Disappear. I am not an economist. Many people think I am, but it is, of course, known as the dismal science, and it certainly has been dismal in the last 2 or 3 years for Oregon. But hopefully we can have some smiles as we go through this, because it doesn't have to be too dreary, but the numbers themselves certainly are a little on the dreary side. We'll start with unemployment, and then I'll move more into the employment side of the picture. But as you can see on the slides behind me, unemployment peaked at 11.6% during this recession. We actually peaked at about 12.1% back in the recession of the early 1980s. And for my whole career, 27 years plus now, that early 1980s recession has always been the benchmark. That's what everybody compares against. You know, how did each subsequent recession compare? And on this particular one, in terms of unemployment rate, it's easily the closest we've ever gone to that early 80s recession. And statistically, really, 11.6 to 12.1 on the unemployment rate, it's pretty much the same. So really, we can say that on that kind of a measure, these two were very similar. You can see the dramatic increase in Oregon's unemployment rate and for the United States. So many of you have heard me speak before. Unemployment rates can go up and down by a few tenths in a given month, and it really means nothing statistically. But when you see the kind of dramatic increase that we saw, then it obviously means a great deal. One of the changes that we see also is that unemployment in the last two recessions really has dramatically increased both in the rural and in the urban areas of Oregon. And if you go back a while, you know, the traditional thought of an Oregon recession was this soaring unemployment in the rural areas. Yeah. But, you know, people would say, well, Portland or the Willamette Valley, pretty much untouched. And that was probably never completely true, but it's less and less true. The last two recessions, we've seen huge increases in unemployment throughout the state, including the whole Portland area. And part of that is the changing mix of industries, where in the old days the lumber industry would get hammered, and of course that was heavily in the rural areas. Now, across all of manufacturing, we're getting hammered, and there's a lot of manufacturing in the Portland area, in the Willamette Valley, and it doesn't matter if it's high-tech manufacturing, it's getting hammered too in these last two recessions. So we've just seen a lot of job losses. Because of that, we saw this tremendous increase in the number of unemployed. It's all very well to speak about an 11% unemployment rate, but what does that really mean in terms of people? Well, it means that we went from about 80 to 100,000 unemployed in Oregon to a 240,000 number. So it basically tripled over a very short period of years. We're now back around that 210,000 level, but one of the comments I make in many speeches is, yes, unemployment's down from a year ago, but unemployment over 200,000 in a state the size of Oregon is not something that any of us feel good about. You know, that yes is an improvement, but it's an improvement from a pretty rotten situation. And so, you know, none of us are saying, great, you know, we're through this thing, things have improved dramatically. No, they've improved somewhat. And I do want to point to my note there. There's often confusion about unemployment and the unemployment rate. and the way that that interacts with the number of people receiving unemployment insurance benefits because they file claims. And I just want to, I'll make the point briefly that the statistics behind the unemployment rate and the number unemployed is not dependent on whether or not someone is receiving unemployment insurance. So at any given time, somewhere between 50 or right now it's about 80% of the total unemployed are actually receiving an unemployment insurance check. So when you see the numbers that come out of our economic group, those are not impacted by the fact that some individuals didn't receive unemployment insurance or some individuals may have run out of unemployment insurance. Our numbers show everybody whether or not they ever got a UI check or not. Okay, so that's just a real important one because you do hear people saying, well, the unemployment rate's coming down because of people who have run out of unemployment insurance, and that's not true. That is not the way it's computed.
Graham, what percentage of these people did you say are receiving unemployment?
Madam Chair, right now, it's I just checked this morning, actually, it's 84%. And in good economic times, it can be down around the 50% range because the rules for qualifying for unemployment insurance, you know, if you chose to leave your job in the good economic times because you thought you could find something better, you probably wouldn't qualify for unemployment insurance. Right now, with the economy the way it's been, the vast majority of the unemployed are there not because they chose to be there, but because they got laid off. And then many of those would qualify for unemployment insurance. So right now, about 84%. Unemployment rates across the state, well more than half of the state's counties have an unemployment rate in the double-digit range. And I share that just because you think what a big deal it's been nationally when the unemployment rate crept over that 10% range for a while last year. As I recall, it's at 9.9 right now. That's a big deal in the nation's news media and politics. But in Oregon, our unemployment rate's been above double digits for a very long time because of the recession, and many of our counties are. So I just kind of make the point, rural counties, urban counties, many of them are above double-digit unemployment rates. And then I did want to chat a little bit about the labor force, because it's actually one thing to talk about how to bring down the number of unemployed or the unemployment rate, but the mathematical background to that gets very, very complicated. You know, it's easy just to say create jobs, therefore fewer unemployed, therefore a lower unemployment rate, and that is one way to get there. But this labor force is very interesting, and I'd like to just step you through a little scenario that I've used in a number of presentations. You picture yourself as a two-adult family group, and maybe one of the adults stays at home for whatever reason, and one of the adults is out working, and during the early days of this recession, the working adult gets laid off. So that working adult has now gone from the group of employed in this unemployment labor force calculation, they've gone from employed to unemployed. So we've added one to the unemployed. Maybe the other spouse, who is not in the labor force at this point, that person is choosing not to be in the labor force, maybe they join the labor force because they think, well, one of us needs to work. I better start looking. So now suddenly you've had one layoff, but you've added two people to the unemployed side of the equation. Because if you're not looking for work, you're not counted as unemployed. Then you fast forward 6 months, neither of them have found a job. What might happen? They might get discouraged. You've heard about discouraged workers, and they quit looking for work because they're discouraged. They're going to look again in the spring because they know there's no jobs around. At that point, both of those people have moved from unemployed to not in the labor force. And then once they hear, as we did last week, that Oregon started to add a few jobs, maybe both of them jump back into the labor force because now they're hearing, oh, there's some jobs, there's some hiring going on. Our next door neighbor just got hired. They jump back into the labor force, but they jump back in as unemployed. And it's not till one or both of them actually find a job that you get back to where you started when all of this happened. And so one of the things that can happen is that when we start adding jobs, ironically, the unemployment rate can go up. Because we may have more people coming back in the labor force because they think there's good news, and they join the ranks of the unemployed before they find a job and move into the ranks of the employed. So I just wanted to make the point that this labor force thing, it's one number that's published every month, but below that number, there's almost 2 million people churning, making individual decisions, and each of those can impact the unemployment rate regardless of how many jobs were added. One of the numbers there is that just to keep pace with Oregon's normal population-related growth, we need to be adding about 1,500 jobs a month. That just keeps us even over the long term. Okay, that would not reduce the unemployment rate. That would just keep us even, because in Oregon, typically, there's more people moving into the state than moving out of the state. And if we want to see the unemployment rate come down, then we need to add a lot more than 1,500 jobs a month. And when I talk about employment, keep that 1,500 in mind, because, you know, I'll put it in perspective with what we actually did last month. So one of the question that was implied by the subject of the presentation was, how do we bring down the unemployed? Well, again, it's one factor in a very dynamic labor force. This is not some neat mathematical, you just change one thing and everything else falls into place. There's almost 2 million people making individual decisions. There's 100,000 businesses making individual decisions. So it's a very complicated thing. But number two there, unemployment can fall for reasons that we would not think of, you, I think, as policymakers, would not think of as good reasons. One is out-migration. If all the unemployed give up and leave Oregon, the unemployment rate would become very low very quickly. But I don't think we'd feel good about that as a public policy. And I joke about that in presentations, because some states that have very low unemployment rates, South Dakota, Nebraska, some others like that, they have very low unemployment rates, and we have people ask us, well, what are they doing right? It's not that they have a great economy. It's that most of their unemployed, certainly some of their unemployed, are leaving town. And where are they moving? To places like Oregon, which is why we have to create 1,500 jobs a month, because people keep moving here. And I bet many of you and many of the people behind me were not born in Oregon. I do this in presentations all the time. Raise your hands if you were not born in Oregon. And oftentimes it's 50, 60, 70% of the people in the room were not born here. So those were all people that we had to find jobs for, including me, over the years. Okay. Discouragement. The unemployment rate could go down if all the unemployed became discouraged and quit looking. But that's not a useful way to bring unemployment down. The really useful way to bring unemployment down is by adding jobs, and that's really the focus. And so I asked some of our staff to just kind of play with some numbers, and it was certainly a very quick play with numbers last week, to say what would we have to do in terms of adding jobs to get the unemployment rate down to, say, the 6% range, where it was just a few years ago, from the 11% or 10% range where it is today. And if we wanted to get there by 2015, which seems a long way out, if we wanted to get to 6% by 2015, on average, we'd need to add about 3,000 jobs a month. Okay, and again, in a couple slides, I'll tell you what happened last month so you can put this in perspective. And we wouldn't add 3,000 every month, but on average, we would add 3,000. We may add 10,000 one month and lose 100 the next month, but on average, we'd be looking to add about 3,000. And if we wanted to get there a whole lot quicker, as in, say, 2012, we'd have to add close to 5,000 jobs a month. And I can certainly tell you it's been quite a while since we've added 5,000 jobs in any month, let alone to add that on a month-by-month average. So again, this will make more sense even starting right now. Let me change gears here more to the employment side. So I'm shifting from unemployment. And we released our latest numbers last Tuesday. I'm sure you heard, just through the radio or newspapers, those numbers. And April's 3,900 increase, certainly the best month we've seen in a very long time. If you look at this graph, all of the ones that are below the zero line, those are monthly job losses. I actually ran this program for Oregon in the late 80s, early 90s. And as you can kind of get a sense over on the left of the graph, it's pretty unusual for Oregon to gain or lose more than 5,000 jobs in a month, just the size of our state. But you can see as we went into this recession, we were losing 10, 15, 18,000 jobs in a single month. And even for people like my staff and I, who are numbers people, statistics, economics people, these were bordering on emotional numbers, because every one of these is not just a statistic. These are people with families who just lost their jobs. And so even as we have our little, we have a monthly meeting as we prepare for the news release, even as we sat around the table just looking at tables of numbers, we were really kind of in shock for two or three of those months in the winter of last year, January, February period, when you realize the magnitude and the pace of these job losses. In the last few months, 6 months or so, certainly the pace has changed dramatically. In fact, if you look back over the last few months, we've barely lost any jobs. So that's a great turnaround from where we were even just a year ago or a year and 3 or 4 months ago. But we haven't been significantly adding jobs until this very last month. That would have been the data for April. So we did have 3,900. The initial reaction was, okay, how many of those are just census jobs? Right now, any job's a good job, even if it is a temporary one. But how many of those were census? And it was about 1,000. So that suggests, okay, there were other jobs being added too. We know the census jobs aren't here for very long, but there were other jobs added too. So remember I said we want to be adding at least 1,500 a month just to keep pace, and maybe 3,000 a month to start bringing the unemployment rate down. That's not just 1 month. That's over months and months and months. But this puts it in perspective. It's pretty hard to be adding 3,000, 5,000, 7,000 a month, month after month, except if we were to have a pretty strong turnaround. And we'll look at some of the official forecast numbers in a minute. So a lot of people ask us and have been asking us for months, are we at the trough? Are we at the bottom? Have we bottomed out in employment and now we're going to start turning around? And the answer is we don't know. Nobody really knows. I mean, this is an even in a normal recession, nobody really knows this until after the fact. But in this kind of a recession, certainly nobody knows. But interestingly, Tom Botowski's most recent forecast, and pretty consistent with his last two or three forecasts, suggested that we would bottom out in the winter that we've just come through. And the last forecast said we'd bottom out in the first quarter of 2010, and then we would start growing again. And our numbers so far, which are based on surveys of businesses, our numbers so far are saying that was right on. So that's very encouraging. Now, it could go down next month. We got excited in January because we added, I think it was 1,000 or 400 or something. We thought, oh, maybe this is the turnaround, and in February we lost some jobs. So, you know, nobody's saying that a one-month 3,900 gain means we've turned the corner. But it was, as I said, the most positive thing we've seen in a very long time. It was also positive for the private sector, which a lot of people are focused on. Government seems to be holding up pretty well, particularly with stimulus funds, but private sector is really suffering, and there's evidence of that, and I'll show you a particular graph later. But private sector also, for the first time since February of 08, did actually add jobs last month. And again, 1 month does not make a trend, so I don't want anybody to think I'm here saying we added jobs in April, it's all over, you know, the recession's over, good times are coming back. We're a long way from that. But I'd much rather be here saying we added 1,100 jobs than we lost another 5,000. Construction has been absolutely brutalized in this recession, as it was in the early 80s. And so, you know, there's, in fact, we've been doing some looking at the comparisons just in terms of the magnitude of the job loss. Construction added a few hundred jobs in the last couple months. So, again, relatively, that's really positive. But if you put it in the context of an industry that's lost 30 or 40,000 jobs, you know, gaining 400 is nothing. And you can see the slope of the graph there. Construction is now at an employment level that it was last at in 1994. So Tom Botowski talks about the lost decade. You may have heard him use that phrase, where in many industries we're back at employment levels we haven't seen in 10 years. Well, in construction, it's far worse than that. 1994, I mean, if you think back to what you may have been doing that far back, construction had this incredible growth. Many people, incidentally, said that peak that you can see up there was unsustainable. And people were very worried that construction would have significant job losses, and it did. But I've talked to a lot of people who made those comments 3, 4, 5 years ago that it was unsustainable, and pretty much all of them also admit that they never dreamed it would fall this far. You know, people maybe dreamed it would lose 10 or even 20,000 jobs. Sure. But to see it come down this far.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, construction is something I've thought a lot about. I'm in the housing business. I mean, I own apartments and so on, and so I've thought about it a lot. It strikes me that with the tremendous drop in home values, that you can't build homes for what they're now valued at. And until that turns around and we get home values back up closer to what the actual cost of building them is, it's going to be really hard for this industry to recover. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Monroe, I certainly don't claim to be an expert on, you know, the mechanics of the industry, but what you've said makes sense. And I think the other thing is there are just so many houses out there for sale that why would you build more houses right now and just add to that, because those houses already have lost so much value. Until you start getting some of those disappearing off the market, the housing prices won't even start coming up. And if you start then building more and more houses, you're just prolonging that low housing value. So, and it's not just housing. I mean, construction is down across many sectors, but housing certainly was, you know, the one that we all heard about when we started going into this. So, okay. Thank you. Manufacturing has also probably been the other big loser, although there were many losers. You'll see several of the graphs I show. I mean, there were very few industries that skirted this recession, and, well, not completely, but even somewhat. Manufacturing took some huge hits. We in Oregon, if you look at this graph, you'll see that it tends to go down, and then it goes back up again, at least to a certain extent, and then it drops in the next recession. And then it picks back up again, but maybe not to the same level. And that's kind of what we're expecting this time again. Overall, the long-term trend is every time we lose a bunch of jobs, we don't gain them all back. We come back to a lower peak, and then we lose some more. So the long-term trend is downwards. In many states in the nation, the manufacturing graph would just be a long-term downward trend. They wouldn't even have the kind of recoveries that we've had that you see here. But this particular time, durable goods manufacturing was really hard hit. Durable goods, things that last more than 3 years. So in Oregon, that's metals, it's wood products, it's transportation employment or transportation equipment, so rail cars and RVs and so on. And we were really patting ourselves on the back 3 or 4 years ago because we were doing so well in those and in high tech. So we thought, boy, you know, compared with a lot of states, Oregon's doing great in some of these manufacturing areas, and we were. And we may do great again. But when this recession hit, manufacturing got clobbered. So if you were a state with not much manufacturing left, you may not have suffered so much. If you were a state with a lot of manufacturing that actually was doing pretty well relatively, then you got clobbered. And that's certainly where we were, as you can see here. It has stabilized. And I hesitate to use too positive a word here, but you can just see the free fall, as with many industries, it does seem to have somewhat stabilized in the last few months. And the picture in the service sector...
Graham, before you move on, Senator Przanski has a question.
Graham, I should have probably asked this question earlier, but you keep on referring to recession. I look at that chart that you had on page 2 of your handout showing how we peaked as unemployment is so high. Why recession versus depression? Why are we not using what seems to me to be somewhat obvious as to that type of unemployment numbers being off the charts, even above and beyond our hallmark of the recession of 82-85.
Right. Madam Chair and Senator Przanski, I think early in this recession, when the unemployment rates were going up substantially, I'm sure there are definitions of depression versus recession that are not coming to my mind at this moment, but I know that the discussions back then were really that probably back there were no statistics for Oregon back in the Depression, the real Depression. Mm-hmm. But I think the numbers that I've heard bantered around would be unemployment rates in the 20-25% range. Right. So, I mean, that's even a whole different level to what we're experiencing now. Back in the 80s, everybody talked about that as a recession. It wasn't comparable to the Depression. And really, as we've shown, and I'll show you on the employment side too, we've fallen just fractionally short on both unemployment and employment losses of that 80s recession. So I think everybody's pretty comfortable saying this is a huge recession, but it really doesn't get close to the magnitude of unemployment and job losses that we think would have happened in the Depression.
Thank
even
you.
Though we don't have numbers for that.
Thanks for your explanation.
Okay. Manufacturing and construction make up the big part of what's called the goods producing sector, and as you can see, they've been absolutely hammered. Huge parts of the service sector also were hammered in the early part of the recession, but they seem to have been turning around a few months ago. So, for example, and I'll move fairly quickly on these, but for example, this one's wholesale trade, and the next one is retail trade. And you can see in the last couple months look a bit dicey, but overall it looks like through last winter retail trade did make a turn. But I would still point out that when you say things are looking a little better, but in a growing state like Oregon, employment today is where it was 7 years ago. Better becomes a very relative term. That doesn't feel better to most of us. We're used to retail trade growing year after year after year, not being back at the levels it was at 7 years ago. Professor?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Do we have, on service area, do we have statistics on how many service-related small businesses have closed, have gone bankrupt compared to what you would expect in normal times? I mean, I'm thinking of you know, small restaurants or small shops that are basically service-related. Do you have any numbers on how many small businesses have failed because of this recession?
Madam Chair and Senator Munro, I'm thinking we have a couple of sources that track companies through contractions and closures, and we'll take a look at that with staff to see if we can come out with it within those particular industries and sizes of firm. The other thing I'm thinking of would be something like Small Business Administration. So I know some of my folks are watching this, and one of them's here. So we'll make a note to check into that.
Thank you.
We'll see what we can find for you. Okay. Okay, professional business services is one that we pay a lot of attention to. Often when we talk about services, people's minds go to low-wage, minimum-wage, part-time-ish kind of jobs. And this professional business services really serves, as the name implies, a lot of businesses. This is things like accounting firms, law firms, engineering firms, consulting firms. So by no means is this low-wage kinds of or low-skilled jobs. But it also includes the employment services arena, in other words, temporary help and employee leasing. And a lot of people really expect that temporary help will turn a corner before we see the broader employment turn a corner. I'm not sure that that's as true as it may have been in some recessions. And part of that is because so many people right now are on furloughs or reduced hours that you can certainly kind of picture a scenario where when that company's demand picks up, they will simply move their existing employees back to full time. They wouldn't go out and hire a temp. They'd just make this 20 hours a week person back to 40 hours a week, which is where they were 2 years ago. So you can see that it may not always be go hire a temp, but I think there will be some truth to that. And I was interested to see that in the numbers we released last week was the first time since November 2007 that this employment agency's temporary help leasing was actually above year-ago levels. So those employment firms have gone substantially down. Earlier this year in a presentation, I had several people in the audience from temporary help companies, and they were all saying that they were seeing a significant upturn in their bookings and their business requests. So I think we're starting to see that play out in the numbers, but clearly, again, as with pretty much everything, we're a long way from where we were. Health services, you'll certainly see this when I talk to the 10-year projections. Health services has been impacted by the recession. I wouldn't want to say they haven't. We certainly have data on companies, hospitals, doctors' offices that have reduced hours or reduced employment because of the recession. But overall, health services is not seeing the kind of declines that almost every other industry is seeing. And as we look to the future, it's clearly the one industry that we do expect to grow pretty substantially. Let me chat for a moment about government. You can see that government also has not taken that kind of dive that we saw even with wholesale or retail trade, let alone with construction. And I share this next graph with some personal risk probably because I know that some people don't like to see that the components of government really haven't taken the dive that the private sector has. And I think there's a number of good reasons for that, but I wanted to show it to you so you can play through here and just kind of track these. The green line that has the peaks, that's federal government, and the peaks really relate to census workers, both the preparation work from last year and then the most recent one, the actual census work this year. The red line is state government. And I know people may react to that with some horror that, in these times of huge private sector losses, how in the world can state government be growing like this? And a lot of the answer has to do with government's response to the recession. Social services, unemployment insurance, across several of those areas of government that specifically and often are federally funded to deal with this. And of course, the stimulus funds kicks in heavily too. The local government is kind of the burgundy just above the 100 line, 100 meaning it's where it was when the whole recession started. And you can see local government, it's had a few losses, but it's still slightly above where it was before. But local government has had some significant losses in local education and in county and city government work. But because of the stimulus, those have been certainly much less severe than they would otherwise have been. And then you track down, the total is the blue and the private sector is the kind of pink color, and you track those two down and you see the overall damage from this recession. As I say in the title, this is a graph I'm going to keep month by month. And it will be very interesting to see, as the private sector turns around, what happens to these government employment numbers as you go into the next biennium, and as local government suffers from the end of the stimulus funding. You know, stimulus funding may have helped keep some teachers employed this year, but it may not be there next year. So what will happen to these, even in the next 2 or 3 or 5 years, as the private sector hopefully starts to rebound? This is a slide that I've used many times in the last 2 or 3 years, and it's basically what I, if I had to pick one slide that I would just tell someone, here's the recession at a glance, this would be it. And the two shocking ones, you've already seen a different representation, manufacturing and construction. I think even more shocking is when you see the percentages. It's one thing to say it's lost 40,000 jobs, but let's put that in perspective. For construction, it essentially means 4 out of every 10 jobs are gone. And in the early 80s recession, it was right around 5 out of every 10 jobs for construction. So again, we've been doing some background work comparing which parts of construction were hit harder back then and now. But the bottom line is that, you know, what we thought was an almost unbelievable decline in the early 80s has really repeated itself here in the 2009-10 period. And here's a brand new graph that I hope I get to use a lot more in coming months, which is based on the assumption, and it's a ridiculous assumption right now, that March was the low point. And I realize it's ridiculous, so let me say that on the record. But if a year from now we look back and March indeed was the low point, hopefully this graph will then show how well some industries have rebounded from that low point, as opposed to the previous one, which shows how much industries have dropped from their previous high point. And just look at the scale here. This graph is on a scale where 50,000 jobs lost is the graph. This one is on a scale where 8,000 jobs gained. You know, so remember that those are very different scales. Just some other brief comments. We've lost so far in this recession. Let's see. I think that number is a little outdated. I apologize for that. The 123,000, I believe we should be to 149. So a bad number slipped in there. But 149,000 is the decline there. Compare that to the early 1980s. If we were to adjust it for the size of the state that Oregon is today, we're obviously a lot bigger state than we were in 1980. If we adjusted the 80s recession to today's labor force, we'd be at 193,000 jobs lost. So even as bad as everything has been that I've showed you, it would be even worse if you were actually back in the early 80s recession. And that's hard for some people to believe, people that weren't here in the 80s. Some of those graphs, you would literally add on a third more job losses to get to where we are today. And that's pretty shocking. I do want to point out, over the long term, Oregon has done a great job of adding jobs. I've had legislators ask me to do special studies. You know, why is it that Connecticut adds jobs, or why is it that so-and-so adds jobs? And if you take the long-term view, the green line here is job growth in Oregon, and the red line is job growth in the United States. And you can see, yes, we suffer in recessions, but overall, we've done a really great job of growing and growing faster than the U.S. So the hope for all of us is that once we turn the corner here, we get back into that more rapid growth. Hitting the wrong way. And here, I think, for one more day is the official state forecast. My understanding is that Tom Pitowski brings you his new forecast tomorrow. I think many of the trends will be similar. I'm sure some of the levels will change. That's a natural part of what he does. But I just want to point out again that his current forecast is that we bottom out in the first quarter of this year, so we've just passed that point. I also want to point out that we don't get back to the earlier employment level until 2013. In fact, well into 2013. And when, you know, that strikes people as pretty troubling. You hear about jobless recoveries, or maybe it's a slow job gain recovery. But 2013 seems a pretty long way away in terms of when do we get back to that old employment level. But I don't think there's anybody really that would doubt that that's roughly along the right lines. We are not expecting to see rapid job growth as we bounce back from this. A lot of companies can probably take care of their customer demand by either continuing to improve productivity, which we've already seen, or by bringing existing workers back to full-time hours. They won't need to add new bodies in large numbers in these immediate days. Just in closing, a few slides about our long-term projections, and I believe I presented some of this to some of you late in the 2009 session. where one of the jobs for the Employment Department is to predict employment trends over the long 10-year kind of horizon, not for the sake of predicting recessions, because that's what Tom Petowski does, and we don't need to be duplicating that, but from the point of view of career development, what kinds of classes should our community colleges be offering? What kinds of careers should our young people be considering? And so as we look out over the 10-year period, you can see we're looking at about a 9% growth rate, which is certainly the slowest that I've seen in my career. Oftentimes, we've been in the 14, 16% growth rates for Oregon over a 10-year period. One of the reasons is that at the very bottom, we've got to dig ourselves out of this huge hole before we even start adding the growth. Because these projections, this is part of a national system. All the states do these kind of on the same time frames. And so between 2008, which is the base year for these projections, and where we are today, we've lost thousands more jobs. So actually, if you think back to the Tom Petowski forecast, it takes us till 2013 just to dig out of the hole, and then we start what you could call real new job growth beyond just getting back to where we started. And that's vividly shown in this graph. As you see, the bright blue lines are the history, the darker shading are the projections, and the first group of darker shading are Tom Petowski's current projections, and then the one that's way out there at 2018 is that number that we've pegged of where we think we'll be. And as you can see in some of the little box there, we've actually lost 5% more jobs between just 2008 and 2009. Let alone what may happen in 2010. So that 9% rate from 08 to 18 is really more like a 15% growth rate, much stronger growth rate if you track it from 09 to 18. Because we were deep in a hole, so to get there, we actually have to grow pretty substantially from where we are today. It just doesn't look like it if you take it from 08. For the first time ever, we do project manufacturing will be lower 10 years out than it was when we started the projections. So lower in 2018 than it was in 2008. The good news, if there is any, is that we do predict manufacturing will be higher then than it is today. And again, we've lost jobs since we started these projections, but we think we will come back somewhat. I would also draw your attention to health services. The education and health services there, that's private sector, so it's a little bit of private education, private universities, colleges, private career schools, but a whole lot of health services. That really dominates. And you can see, you know, the span there, 23% growth for the health services-related industry, 1% growth for construction.
So, excuse me, so the public sector education jobs are reflected in government category there?
Madam Chair, yes, exactly. And we do have probably 300 lines of detail on these projections, you know, to show how government breaks out and how all of the different healthcare breaks out. Obviously, for today, I didn't bring those. But so again, manufacturing, I won't belabor this, manufacturing lost a lot more jobs since we did the projections. As you can see, if you kind of track the last six or seven bars on the graph, we do believe manufacturing will grow from where it is today, and we think the same thing is true of construction. But in neither case will they get back to their pre-recession employment levels, certainly during this 10-year period. And in the case of manufacturing, quite literally, perhaps never. It's quite conceivable that Oregon manufacturing could even be healthy and producing a tremendous amount of product, but never get back to the employment level that it had before. Okay, and again, we've seen that over several cycles of recessions. Which industries will add the most jobs? It's pretty much in the service sector. And you can see healthcare comes out high on some of these, and these are just adding the most jobs. Healthcare, the four components are all on this list. Food services, I mean, that is just an enormous industry group. So it's no wonder they're adding lots of jobs. But as we look at the percent growth, the top four there are all the components of healthcare. It's so far ahead of everything else that it's almost bound to be at the top. Several manufacturing industries, obviously, would be the opposite. They're the ones that are expected to lose or be lower 10 years from now than they are today. Looking around Oregon, The good news is that all regions are expected to add jobs, so that's positive. It hasn't always been true in Oregon, but generally has been so. Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson, so Bend, Redmond, Prineville, Madras, that area, we predict it to be the fastest growing, which we've predicted for all but one cycle of these projections in my memory, but a pretty different projection. I mean, at times that may have been in the mid to high 20s range, and now it's in the 14% range. And as many of you know, and some of you particularly, the Bend area certainly has been, you know, severely hammered with housing and with other things during this recession. But as you look across Oregon and you think, where are the places that are most likely to bounce back and start growing again, maybe not with the same vibrancy that they had 2 years ago, not for a while, but they will grow, the Bend area still comes to mind as one that's going to be strong, as does the Medford, Klamath Falls kinds of areas. You can see on the other end some of the very rural areas still growing slowly, and that, I think, is something that Oregon is used to. I'm not saying it's good, but that has been the reality for some parts of eastern Oregon. Some of the coastal areas, Coos and Curry counties, have often been on the slow end of the growth. I do want to emphasize that it's not all about growth. And when we talk about workforce preparation, it's not just about are there going to be new jobs. It is about how many people might retire from the jobs that already exist. Because if we need welders, for example, or nurses, or pick any occupation you want, it's not just a question of how many new hospitals will be built or how many more nurses will the hospitals need. It's also a question of how many nurses are going to leave nursing, either because they get tired of it, or they retire, or they die, or for any other reason. They go into management. You know, if they go into management, they're not actively a nurse anymore. So we need to replace those. And that's what we mean by replacement openings. And the big part of that is retirements. And that's where everybody's mind always goes to. And so what we're saying is, in this 10-year period, we predict about 160,000 growth openings for Oregon, across all of its companies. But we predict about 430,000 replacement openings. So where that plays out is really important would be a graph like this. If I'm talking to a high school career fair and I talk to young people about manufacturing or construction jobs and I only talk about the growth openings, I clearly would say to them, don't even think about manufacturing as a career. You would be crazy. But if I talk to them about manufacturing in terms of the growth openings and the replacement openings, knowing that quite a few manufacturing workers are in their 50s, particularly in some of those higher wage manufacturing industries, then it becomes a perfectly reasonable thing to say to those young people, there's not a lot of growth projected, but there are a lot of retirements, and if that's something that interests you as a young person, if that's, you know, your area of skill and interest, and maybe you've got some family history with that, there's nothing wrong with saying be the best machinist or the best welder or the best whatever it is you can be, because there will be jobs in manufacturing. But if you only look at the growth, you miss all that. And I think one of the biggest dangers, and I know I've said this to Oregon's Workforce Board, for us as workforce people, one of the biggest failures we could have would be 10 years from now for manufacturing companies to be leaving Oregon, not because of roads or taxes or any of those other things, but simply because they couldn't find enough skilled workers. And then we as the public sector workforce system and the community colleges and our partners would be looking at ourselves and saying, but we knew there were going to be manufacturing workers retiring. Why didn't we train some people to fill in the gaps behind them? And because we didn't train people, that manufacturing company just left Oregon. So that's something, and I know Greg White's behind me, that's something that I know the Workforce Board and many others take very seriously. We have lots of discussions about these replacement openings. Here's the same thing just based on an industry look, and I won't belabor the point, but you certainly see manufacturing. You know, there's a couple of components of manufacturing that may add some new jobs, but almost all of the job needs in manufacturing are replacement, same thing in construction. Same thing in a lot of them. You'll see the health services is the only one where it's about a 50-50 split between the new jobs and the replacement openings. Last slide, some of you may be wondering about green jobs. And as you may know, we did a special study on green jobs last year. I think it was very helpful for Oregonians, for policymakers, not because we ended up saying there are, you know, millions of green jobs or they're growing, you know, 500% per year, which is probably what some people were thinking, But because we were actually able to put some moderate and reasonable numbers on the green jobs discussion, we found about 50,000 green jobs in Oregon. It's about 2 or 3% of the total in the state, very similar to what other states have now found in their own surveys. We found that they were spread across all industries, many occupations, and until that time, a lot of the discussion of green jobs had to do with wind turbines and solar panels. And I think one of the things our survey helped do was to say, no, this is about farm workers and sustainable forestry, loggers, which surprised some people. It's about electricians and plumbers. It's about a lot of occupations that we all know, but they're doing things a little bit differently. They may be getting a few new skills. So today's presentation isn't about green jobs. We have a report. I'd be happy to chat more about that. But I did just want to throw that in for you to just say, you know, if that's an area of interest, we certainly do have a complete report that we can easily provide to you. And I know it's been distributed to you already, but it may be in a mass of papers that you'd like a new copy. So, Madam Chair, that wraps up.
Did those numbers reflect existing jobs then?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And how about the growth in that sector then?
Well, Madam Chair, we asked, and I actually didn't include it in the bullets here, one of the questions we did ask, as requested by the Workforce Board, was what kind of percent growth those companies expected in their green jobs in the next couple of years. And if memory serves, I think they said it was about 14%. And that's in a two-year period where Oregon was still losing jobs from 2008 to 2010. However, one of the reasons it's not on this summary slide is, you know, we really felt that was a pretty weak number. You know, how many businesses in 2008 could have predicted accurately what was happening in their employment for all jobs, given what happened to the economy in those 2 years? I don't think anybody probably really understood how bad things would be. So I don't know that they could predict it that well for their green jobs. So, you know, it's in our report, and we did include it as this is what the businesses told us. But I think it's not the kind of number we'd want to base too much public policy on. We also, the chair of the Workforce Board, also made the point when I presented this to them that a lot of those new green jobs, even those were just existing jobs, whereas some of the job duties would be changing. It wasn't that they were adding brand new jobs. It's that they had, you know, 50 electricians, and more of them were getting the skills they needed for certain new kinds of solar installation, for example. So they would might become a green job by the definition, but it was still just one electrician who would work for that company for 10 years. But they are getting a few new skills. So.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Are there questions? Yes, Senator Monroe.
I'm the only one that was actually here in the 80s during that recession, and I remember it well, and I almost lost my business. But also, from your numbers, it looks like it took from until about 1987 before we got back to the level of employment we were at in 1980. And so that makes me think that the projection of us not getting out of this hole until 2013 might be a little optimistic. And I've seen some other numbers and read from some other economists that think that it may take even longer than that. So Tom tends to see things optimistically, I think, often in his projections. The other thing that comment I would like to make is about nursing. Clearly, all your numbers and all the numbers we've seen says that there's going to be a huge demand for more and more nurses. And community colleges train nurses. I'm on the board of Mount Hood Community College. We train nurses, but we turn away about 4 out of every 5 that apply to our nursing school because we don't have the room and the dollars to educate them. It's more expensive to educate a nurse than it is to educate some other dental hygienist or something like that. And yet, when the state pays community colleges FTE, they pay it based on the same for all of your training that you do across the board. And since nursing training is more expensive, colleges that are in financial straits can't expand the number of nurse trainees that they accept because the dollars just aren't there. I think we need to look, I think the state needs to look at how we compensate community colleges, for example, in their training of different people and maybe make some adjustments for those very high cost programs like nurses training.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, on both of your comments, I'm nodding understanding. I don't know that you want a response from me. You know, on the early 80s, I will say you're absolutely right. It took a very long time, and in the movement towards the job losses, that's been one of the startling things in this recession is how fast we lost so many jobs. It was a little more spread out on the downside as well as on the upside in the early 80s. If we get a year from now and we start having another phase of big layoffs, it will start feeling a lot more like the early 80s because the layoffs didn't just quit then. I started in 1983. And I remember in 84, I was a regional economist for the Lynn-Benton area, and that's when Lebanon and Sweet Home were still having huge lumber mill layoffs, allegedly 3 years after the big recession period, but it just didn't quit. And so hopefully that's not what we're facing now. As to nursing, you know, there certainly our data, there have been some increases, in fact, some substantial increases in the number of nursing slots. But everything you said about many more candidates for the positions available and the costs are absolutely correct. I know many people take that very seriously, including you.
Well, thank you. I know that you need to get on the road to get to the airport. So we really appreciate you taking the time and changing your plans to be with us. And this has gotten our hearing off to a great start. So thank you, as always. And I think we're actually our next witness is going to be testifying
via video conference.
Do we need
to be at ease, Sue? Or are we?
Oh, we're already got ready. Okay. Oh, we're all set up. Okay. So, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, Professor Dewey, have you been watching the initial part of our hearing?
I've been watching it for about the last half hour, yes.
Oh, great. Well, sure. We're really glad that you could join us in this virtual format, and we know that you also have other things going on this morning, so we'll move right into your presentation.
All right, well, thank you very much, Chair Rosenbaum. I'm a bit at a disadvantage. This is not my normal means for giving a presentation, and I was also a bit at a disadvantage of exactly what the committee was looking for as I worked on preparing my comments. What I would like to start with is a more of a general overview. I unfortunately, in this format, I don't have all my usual charts and figures. But I was listening to previous comments and would like to add that it does seem pretty clear that we're moving from the recession state of the economy into a more expansionary state, and that expansion looks increasingly sustainable as we move through the data, particularly on a national level. I think one thing you always have to keep in mind is, although we focus a lot of course, on Oregon, that Oregon really is something that mimics and follows national trends. And the national trends here have tended to be on the positive for several months now. The sustainability and the strength of the recovery, particularly later this year and into next year, still seems to be an issue of a great amount of debate among economists. And the question really is, as we move through this initial state, can we continue to have significant economic growth once we take off the fiscal stimulus? Your previous speaker was already discussing the issue of for example, state and local jobs in particular that might have been dependent upon stimulus spending, and how there's the possibility that as we move forward into the next biennium that the local and state jobs don't grow or contract. So that's the one headwind we're really still looking at going into the future that we're trying to evaluate. In the near term, it does seem like we've had a relatively rapid pace of growth in the last couple of quarters. Now, the second issue, on top of the issue of whether or not we have sustained job growth later this year and into next year, is that even with the kinds of job growth that we've seen, and the kinds of economic growth that we've seen, it hasn't been significant to generate very strong job growth overall. If we go back to the period on a national basis, the early 80s, and this is a little bit different than the Oregon experience, but after we moved through 1982 and head into 1983-84, on a national basis, jobs grew very rapidly and the unemployment rate dropped. Oregon was out of sync, as was earlier discussed in that episode. the challenge that we're having this time is not only one of uncertainty about the sustainability of the recovery as we move out of this stage of fiscal stimulus and continue and having to rely on private demand more, and then the second problem is that we're not seeing the strength of growth to rapidly improve the jobs picture. And that gets you to the question of whether or not 2013 is too optimistic to get back to our own jobs profile, and whether or not we need to be thinking more in the lines of 2015 or 2013 to 2015, sometime in that longer range rather than the more narrow range. And this is simply an unanswered question right now. At the heart of it, though, we know that certain factors that generally pull us out of a recession are just simply not in place at this point. One of those factors in particular is housing, whereas in most previous expansions and right after a recession, you tend to have a very rapid growth in the housing market, particularly when I say housing, I mean new residential construction. We have not seen that as of yet. We've seen some lift in housing activity in recent months, but that seems to be largely dependent upon temporary tax credits. And we also know that there's an enormous amount of foreclosures that are supposedly still in the pipeline and coming down the road as we move through the rest of this year. And as that occurs, should depress additional housing activity. So we know this one factor that typically is a significant boost for economic output as we move out of the recession just simply isn't there right now. And the lack of that extra boost, I think, is certainly something that's, again, containing economic activity so that although we're seeing growth, we're not seeing the speed of growth that we typically associate with as we move into a typical type of recovery. So our two main factors, at least, that seem to be governing the near and medium-term dynamics is one, whether or not there's enough push from the private sector to take over as the public sector weans itself from spending as we move into the second half of this year and into next year. And the jury is still out there. My sense is that there's still enough private demand to keep the economy from slipping back into recession. But the challenge on this point still is the second point, is that even with continued growth, it doesn't seem like we're seeing growth that's significant to rapidly change the unemployment rate, rapidly bring down the unemployment rate. What we would need to see is probably job growth on twice the order of magnitude that we've been seeing from the private sector, excluding the temporary census jobs, to start to make really rapid, significant dents in unemployment, both nationally and locally as well. So that's another challenge. And then there's the third challenge as we move into more Oregon-centric issues is that we're following these national trends. There's been a couple of national trends that I've been more concerned about over the last decade. For instance, beginning somewhere in the late 70s, Oregon's average wage growth started to trail at a pace less than the U.S. And this leaves me somewhat concerned going forward that if we don't arrest that trend, that we're going to have ourselves a widening gap between wages here and the wages in the rest of the country. And I think that would be detrimental to our long-run growth, detrimental to attracting high-skilled individuals going forward, and detrimental to financing state functions if wage growth really is declining relative to the U.S., but our cost structure is really rising the same or more so than the U.S. as a whole. I think that's a challenge that we need to work through. And I can leave my comments there and take questions, which might be more fruitful, Chair Rosenbaum, depending on the needs of this committee.
So, members, do you have questions at this point? It doesn't look like you've talked enough to get to that point, so maybe you could go into a little more detail.
No, I'm more than happy to continue on as we move forward. So, I guess getting into more detail on a number of those points, and then I think it's best to work backwards on this, is one of the main concerns I have when I look forward into the next 2 years, 4 years, 5 years, is is twofold. One is that we've lost an enormous amount of jobs that we have to remake, and that you've seen plenty of statistics from your previous speaker, Graham, and he has given you, I think, the accurate information with respect to the state's view and his view, and I think generally my view, with the exception of how long it might take to pull us out of some of this downtrend. So I think that part of the information is very good. What I'm, again, concerned about is the issue of what is going to be the quality of all those jobs going forward. And that seems to be something that I'm seeing when I see the wage data. As we left the late 70s and entered into that period of time, the dark ages, I think, for Oregon's economy, we were tracking about 100% of average wages for the U.S. as a whole. And as we moved into the 1980s, that number dropped significantly, closer to 88-89%. Through the time we got to the end of the 1980s of national wages. So you can see that it's a significant shift, a 10% wage cut relative to the nation as a whole over that period of time. As we move from the late 1980s into the mid to late 1990s, you saw those trends start to reverse, where you saw actual relatively faster wage growth in Oregon than the rest of the nation, so that by the late 1990s, average wages were roughly 94% of the U.S. average. And I think this period of time from the late 1980s to the late 1990s, that decade, maybe 15 years, was a very, very, very nice period of time for the Oregon economy, whereas you saw in the previous chart that we grew a number of jobs very quickly, and in fact the quality of those jobs was going up relative to the U.S., or at least was going up relative to the starting point, so that wages were rising. I think that period of time had a lot of impact in the way we view the Oregon economy as a very productive and growing relative to the U.S. average. The challenge began in this decade, in the 2000s. As we began this decade, we started that with a pretty severe recession from Oregon's standpoint, and we started to see a decline in wages relative to the U.S. as a whole. And by the time we get through 2008, wages in Oregon were back down to about 89% of the average wage in the U.S. as a whole. So we really lost considerable amounts of ground, not just in employment, but also in relative wages over this past decade. And I think that particular aspect of it, the decline in relative wages, has been something that has been overlooked in the general job growth data. Two reasons I care about this trend. Primarily because the welfare issues for state citizens as a whole is are they keeping up to national wage trends and therefore close to national standards of living. So I think that's certainly one question. And the second question is, what's going to happen with state financing as we move into this next decade? Even if we have more job growth, is that job growth going to be sufficient to offset two factors? One, the fact that we haven't had any job growth in essentially a decade. So any spending plans were put in place in the 1990s in this period of time in which Oregon's jobs were growing quickly and wages were growing relatively quickly, all those spending plans are essentially impossible to really achieve after a decade of weaker than average job growth weaker than average wage growth and no job growth. So I think that's a concern. Is that first of all, you have to recognize that there's this structural gap and where we might have been expecting we're going to be here 10 years ago than we actually ended up. And the second issue is, where do you go going forward from there? Is that if you maintain relatively weak wage growth, that obviously is going to funnel directly into personal income tax growth. And then, therefore, to state financing going forward. So I think that in addition to paying just attention to the number of jobs we have and whether or not we recoup these jobs, is what's happening in the quality of these jobs and why is it that we're seeing these relative wage differentials, this relatively slower wage growth than the U.S. as a whole, emerge over really starting in the late 1990s. So this is not a new trend. It's just one that I think has happened relatively slowly, right? You sort of decrease by a half a percentage point a year, and on any given year, it's hard to notice, but by the time you run out 10 years of data and you're 5 to 10 percentage points less than the U.S. average, then you start to say, well, what happened in these last 10 years? How did we sort of step backwards in these gains that we made between 85 and 98, 90, 97? So,
excuse me for just a minute. So, Dr. Dewey, is that a new trend that you're describing?
No. It's really not. So if I just pull up the Bureau of Economic Analysis average wage data for states, basically we hit a bottom in 1988 at about 89% of the national average wages. And then from that point on, we actually rose in average wages until about 1997, which we had about 94% of the average wage of the U.S. as a whole. And then we started declining again to about 89%, 89.4% in 2008. So we've really had, I think, a relatively weak wage growth in this period of time. It would raise the question of is the mix of jobs changing in such a way that it's particularly detrimental? And if you recall, we were able to get quite a bit of benefit of the initial stage of the tech boom in the late the 1990s in general, which was able to really lift wages relative to wage growth here was faster than wage growth in the U.S. as a whole, and as a consequence, average wages as a percentage of the U.S. were rising. We seem to have lost that edge that we gathered during that period of time, and actually the jobs that have been replacing the jobs that lost the first recession, and then when we worry about the second recession, have tended not to be as high a quality as the jobs that we were losing.
Right. Well, I mean, I would assume that reflects what was the earlier presentation talked about, a decline in manufacturing jobs, growth in service sector jobs.
Yes, and certainly that's the one of those issues is that we on one hand we're losing manufacturing jobs and we weren't gaining some of the types of service sector jobs at the pace that other sectors and other states were. So for example, if you think about software production, so the information sector, which obviously is more significant in the Seattle area or the Bay Area relative to, say, the Portland metro area, and other types of significant clusters of technology-related industries apparently grew more rapidly in other parts of the country than we saw in this part of the country.
Thank you.
Yes,
Senator Monroe has a question.
As we've worked our way through this very severe recession, one of the things that this state and I think the federal government have tried to emphasize is extending unemployment benefits and making sure that federal unemployment benefits dovetail with state unemployment benefits so that a large majority of those people, that 10-12% of the population that are looking for jobs, at least have the benefit of those unemployment benefits. It strikes me that if this recession, in fact, is going to be very slow to recover, and I believe it will, I think 2013 is optimistic. I think 2015 is probably closer to reality, that we're going to have to, again, continue to emphasize and fund unemployment benefits far beyond what people normally are allowed to receive. In other words, historically, people get unemployment benefits for a few months, and then they run out, and they're out of luck. Well, that isn't going to work today. I'd like you to comment on the importance of a sustained unemployment benefit program to get us through this recession.
Well, it's certainly been the case that the federal government programs to sustain the unemployment insurance past its normal due dates has been a significant source of relative strength to keeping the economy going during this very difficult period of time. And this is one of the critical issues as we move into this next 2 or 3 years is if we do have this slow growth or slow rebound in jobs and slow decline in unemployment, and if there's some issues with structural unemployment, for instance, you have issues of overexpansion in construction industry, and it's very difficult then as this economy continues to absorb some of the jobs that went into that industry, so that would be a structural issue, then those workers would be at a significant disadvantage going forward, and you would have to think about what are the policies that are appropriate for those particular disaffected people. And one of those policies clearly to extend and sustain unemployment insurance far beyond the typical times, and at least now I'm not particularly concerned. There's a huge detriment to finding work as a result of unemployment insurance being extended. I think this is a particularly difficult recession, and you needed to make that policy choice. Whether or not that would continue in fields that were just simply structurally not coming back very quickly or at all, then you would have to think about, well, maybe unemployment insurance is not alone sufficient to really help those workers, and you have to consider what are the possibilities and probabilities of adequate retraining programs, education programs, et cetera.
Yeah, just let me reflect.
That follow-up.
We all know that unemployment insurance is not the solution, that providing people with unemployment benefits doesn't create jobs, but it does allow them to pay their rent and to put food on the table, and so it's critical. It reminds me of something that Franklin Roosevelt said during the Real Depression, when he was criticized for some of his programs designed to help people put food on the table. And the criticisms went something like this. It's not going to be good in the long run for the United States to have these kind of new programs. And excuse me, his reflection was, well, people don't eat in the long run. They eat every day. And so I just find that it's absolutely critical. Also, we know that every penny that people get in terms of unemployment benefits is spent. It's not saved, it's spent. It's spent on things that they need to sustain life. And so in that way, it does have perhaps a modest stimulus effect.
Oh, Senator Monroe, yes, it does, in fact, have a significant stimulus effect, and certainly is one of the factors that have kept consumption higher than would have been otherwise the case, and also prevent, as a consequence, the recession from being much more worse than would have been the case otherwise. And so I think that undoubtedly that you can add food stamps to the expansion of the food stamp program to that list of programs that has helped ease the pain of this recession and help prevent it from becoming, as you said, the true Great Recession, Great Depression.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I wanted to ask you what confidence you or other economists have right now in predictions. It seems like there is so much disagreement and uncertainty. So what do you think?
Okay, Chair Rosenbaum. The consensus forecast of roughly 3% growth this year, maybe 3.5% growth next year for the U.S. as a whole, and sustained upward trend in the sense that we're not going to have a double dip. The chance of a double dip recession are relatively low. I am fairly sympathetic to that range of forecasts, and I'm sympathetic for two reasons. One, I don't think we're going to have a massive shift in monetary policy over the next 12 months, perhaps over the next 24 months or 36 months for that matter. And I think that type of massive shift of monetary policy is one of the things that would certainly be one of these external shocks, essentially, to the economy that could rapidly change you from an expansionary situation to a back to a recession. So I'm much more confident that forecasts that depend upon relatively stable monetary policy, which is the general, I think, thrust of most forecasts, are solid forecasts. I think the other factor that we can think about here is whether or not we're going to have another oil price shock, which would be the other factor that I think could rapidly plunge us back into recessionary conditions. And for now, it looks like oil prices have been either growing at a relatively consistent rate, and if it's at a relatively consistent rate, agents in the economy can plan for it, and so that's not a problem. And actually, in recent weeks, on the back of the Greek crisis, the crisis in Europe, European debt crisis, we've actually seen oil prices pull back a little. So I'm less worried that we're going to have that kind of shock to the economy that we've seen in prior to previous recessions. So in the absence of the significant external impacts, it would be safe to say that the general patterns of economic behavior over most of the century has been one tending toward economic growth. I would add that although you have these forecasts of, say, 3% growth, which is probably somewhere near what we think of as the long term or the likely likelihood of where the economy is going to grow over time, that's simply not sufficient to rapidly reduce unemployment rates. I'd reiterate that point, is that a 3% growth rate is basically going to add jobs that's slightly above what's necessary to keep the unemployment rate from rising. And we need much, much stronger growth if we want to bring unemployment rates down rapidly. So where I have quite a bit of confidence that the range of forecasts around continued growth backing away from a double dip or another quick recession are solid forecasts. And I think, again, what you come back to is even with relatively, quote-unquote, solid forecasts, is it solid enough to generate the kinds of improvement we really would like to see? And then I think that there's also the question of why are we not seeing that solid growth? And that gets back to issues I talked about earlier, one of which is the housing market, the other of which is financial institutions that are still challenged and not lending as aggressively as we might like to see.
Thank you. And so that leads to another question. I know that, Oregon is a relatively small state. It's difficult for us to have much effect on what's happening since these are national trends, but do you see any policies that could change the outcome one way or the other?
Chair Rosenbaum, the challenge here, of course, is that these are long, what we can affect on state and local levels, I think, tend to be long-run policies. That we have a real challenge, I think, making changes that affect us in the next year or two. And I think that's just the reality of the situation, one which leads us to say, okay, if we want to do policy that is really beneficial to the state over a longer period of time, what kind of strategies can we put in place that are sustainable, that they don't sort of get lost if we have one or two good years of growth? And I think one of the big challenges is getting to what I discussed earlier, is there a significant gap between what the state's likely to collect in revenues over the next 10 years and what our spending habits that have been set in place over the previous 10 years, whether those two things are going to align. And if they're not going to align, really, how are we going to have a discussion about how we're going to make those two things align so that we don't get stuck in this continual pattern where we're just downgrading the existing services that we have? Because I do think those are things that are going to hurt us over the longer run. And as Graham had suggested, your previous speaker, for example, the nursing situation. If we really believe that we're having this shortage of nurses going forward, how are we redirecting resources into addressing that shortfall? And are we doing it in a sustainable fashion? So more than anything, I think what the state government can do, should we want to, is to in fact try to bring some kind of long-run sanity to the state fiscal situation so that we don't sort of suffer through consistent downgrades of services, that we pick the services that we think are, in fact, the ones we want to emphasize and then maintain them as they should be maintained.
Great. Thank you. So other questions for Dr. Dewey? Okay. Well, this has been certainly thought-provoking, and we know that you also have other duties this morning, so we appreciate you taking the time to be with us, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me, Chair Rosenbaum, and you know, I'm more than happy at some point in the future to come to Salem for when I don't have an undergraduate thesis to supervise for this morning. So,
great.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to seeing you in person. Thanks again.
That worked really well.
Yeah. No, we actually did that at a previous hearing that Senator Telfer helped us set up in Bend, and that worked really well too. So, I don't think you were on the committee yet,
No, I wasn't then.
But it was very. It's a technology that really I think should be used more. So we have another portion of the agenda. Members, do you need a break, or should we just keep going? Okay, great. We will move right into the last portion of the agenda, and we've got Business Oregon as well as some business people with us. So, I don't know if you all want to come up together. We've got Lynn Schussler from Business Oregon, the deputy director, as well as Johnny George and Tom Onstand. Good morning, and I know you were here for a lot of the previous presentations, so if you've got any comments about what you heard or just your own presentation, we're looking forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. My name is Lynn Schussler, for the record. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department. Tim McCabe, our director, is in China with Team Oregon right now and expresses his regrets that he couldn't be here. We might be envious of his trade mission trip, but the last time I had a BlackBerry message from him, it was 80-plus degrees and 90-plus humidity, so he's really not having as much fun as I think the weather here in Oregon. So. With me is Tom Onstad. He's with Oregon Ballistic Laboratories, as well as Johnny George here with me from Climax Portable Machine Tools, and we'll hear from them in a little bit, and I'm sure they'll be far more enlightening than my testimony for you today. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and provide an overview of the agency and its programs. What's being handed out to you is some information about our programs specifically, as well as my testimony. I'm going to abbreviate my testimony substantially in favor of letting the two business people speak to you. The programs are defined, the many programs that we have are defined in those handouts. I'm going to try and give you an overview more theoretically or philosophically where our department, under the guidance of its commission, is heading. And now that I've said that, I do want to refer to two specific programs, however, that we do have in the department. I want to quickly reference Senate Bill 1017. As you may remember, we came before you in February to testify in support of Senate Bill 1017. That was an Access to Business Capital Act sponsored by Senator Bonamici. And thank you for your support in that, because what was created by that bill was some policy changes, as well as the bill helped recapitalize the business development fund that we have. That's a revolving loan program that has been instrumental in helping existing small and mid-sized businesses create jobs and retain jobs here in Oregon. That revolving loan fund has assisted more than 400 businesses over the years and helped create more than 8,000 jobs through time. And as you'll hear shortly from Tom, Oregon Ballistic Laboratories was one of those businesses that's benefited from that program. Senate Bill 1017 also made some important changes to the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. And that's the fund that helps provide loans to small business owners and help them get their businesses off the ground or to expand their existing small business with capital. And that's capital that's not otherwise available through traditional lenders. One of the things that we have found and we're continuing to try to address is that lack of capital. The credit markets have not come back. Businesses can't get loans through the traditional lenders. You provided a shot in arm to us the interim session. And to the degree we can continue to capitalize and have funds available, that's something we really would like to focus on. So back to the broader context of the programs. Our department has worked with our commission to move forward a strategic plan that improves the level of services we provide to existing Oregon businesses and those companies that want to locate in our state. And that plan focuses on four specific areas. The first is to strengthen our partnership with both existing companies and economic development organizations to retain and expand job opportunities. The second part targets investments where the state has a competitive advantage, and I'll discuss that a little bit more. The third is to promote increased trade opportunities, and then the fourth is to incorporate innovation into the state's economic strategy. As you've heard this morning, and I'm glad to hear confirmed, economic indicators suggest that Oregon is making some progress in our recovery efforts, and the department's services, programs, and staff are critical, in our view, of ensuring that the state continues to recover from this difficult period. And we must increase our competitive standing in order to be competitive in this global economy. The first goal that the Commission adopted focuses on providing services to help existing business retain and create jobs. Two areas that they have focused on in particular are clean technology and advanced manufacturing. As you know, the state has been very successful in establishing Oregon as a recognized leader in this industry. This has been evidenced by the number of solar companies and solar-related industries now that are forming in our state. The state has been featured for its progress and achievements in media spots over the past few years, and that success has been highlighted. But our business relations range from the broader relations that we might have with Novellus Systems and their consolidation in Tualatin, but also gets down to our regional business officers to helping out entities such as the Rogue Creamery in Central Point. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Rogue Creamery, but it was a very small business, possibly just going to go into demise because the previous owner was just tired, an older gentleman wanted to get out of the business, and through some connections we made, a young group took over, expanded the business, and they've been so attractive and competitive that, in fact, they participated in the London World Cheese and won a first place award, first time that an American cheese had done such an achievement. You're going to hear from Johnny George with Climax Power Tools from Newburgh, who can speak about their company's work, their partnership with Business Oregon, and also we heard about workforce, and they have been rather innovative in their workforce development. The second goal that the Commission adopted was to enhance global trade and international recruitment. We have sought to enhance the role of our international trade officers working with Oregon businesses to explore opportunities for growth and market diversification. Another part of our effort in that regard has to provide small stipends to help Oregon businesses participate in overseas trade events that target their products. In 2009, for instance, we helped seven Oregon companies. The state's $13,000 investment in total for those seven companies yielded export sales to those companies of more than $740,000 in 11 overseas markets. In addition, we have furthered the Team Oregon model that helps other key industry recruitments. Team Oregon, if you're unaware, is a public-private partnership that has increased the state's international presence and yielded a great return. Team Oregon, in fact, is largely responsible for a lot of the state's solar industry growth. Team Oregon, of which Director McCabe is currently participating right now in Japan, Korea, and China, is a combination of delegates that represent state government, local government, businesses, universities, utilities, and on this particular trip, there are two ports as well as Travel Oregon accompanying them. As a result of the trip, as it was announced last week, the state and Mitsubishi have entered into a working agreement that renews their development of an electric vehicle charging network throughout Oregon. And we're optimistic that contacts made during this recent mission will result in additional business development. And I'll volunteer Tim to come back to your committee and tell you about those achievements when he returns. The third goal is of the department is to connect innovation with Oregon businesses. The Oregon Innovation Council provides a bridge between innovative outcomes of the state's research institutions and the know-how of Oregon's entrepreneurs. Innovation and the work of the Oregon Innovation Council are integral to the work that we do as a department and the future competitiveness of Oregon's companies, whether it's assisting directly with food processing, as is one of the initiatives, or seafood industries, which is another, or simply the leverage of federal funds that the innovation program provides. We've leveraged over $200 million of federal resources just for the research activities of the state's universities through this program. And the fourth goal, the one that I'm more familiar with as the director of the Infrastructure Finance Authority, is to assist Oregon's communities build their infrastructure capacity to support their ability to attract and retain businesses, as well as public health and safety issues. Having quality infrastructure assets in place is critical for the communities in Oregon to be able to capitalize on development opportunities as they present themselves. In addition to providing financing for safe drinking water and other traditional community facilities, the department also has an industrial site certification program that works with municipalities, state agencies, private landowners, as well as business to address regulatory issues and ensure industrial lands are ready for development. The final thing that I want to comment on is a myth I hope I can dispel for you. Certainly the success of bringing a new business to the state garners the headlines that we all really like to see. And we do a little bit of that, there's no doubt about that. But the one point I want to emphasize is that the vast majority of our focus is, and that's more than 90% of our focus, is spent working with existing businesses to retain and create jobs and help them grow. It's great to see a big business come into the state, but frankly, we need to support our existing businesses because those little job growths are what really makes the changes that happen. And a little growth across the many, many businesses in our state is certainly what we need to continue to try and achieve. And with that, if there aren't any questions, I'd like to turn it over to Tom or Johnny to talk a little bit about how we've worked with their business.
Okay.
Johnny?
Sure.
Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you.
I'm Johnny George, and I'm the Chief Cultural Officer of Climax Portable Machine Tools in Newburgh, Oregon. And Climax Portable Machine Tools builds portable machine tools for companies all over the world. And we're very proud to say that a big portion of our business of manufacturing is actually exported. So we're bucking the system there a little bit when it comes to the norm of what you're thinking about in manufacturing. Climax has been in business for over 40 years and has been in Newburgh for the majority of that time. We have about 130 employees, and we run at about a $30 million run rate each year. I am here, as Lynn said, as one of the examples of the work that we've been able to do with in partnership with Business Oregon, and in particular with our economic business development officer for our region, which is Tom Fox. He's done a great job in introducing us to different programs and helping us to integrate and collaborate growth within our organization. So, for example, we were able to take advantage of a $5 million industrial revenue bond for our building expansion. We also received a $125,000 forgivable fund from the Strategic Reserve Fund that we used for training. And that training included the principles of lean problem solving and project management. We also got a grant from the Workforce Training Fund, and that grant was on we used that grant for training in creativity and innovation. And all of this training was used across the board for all of our employees, not just a few here and there, but we trained our entire workforce. Our Vice President of Engineering sits on the Governor's Board for Innovation. We have won 3 Mary Paramine Awards in our organization. 2 for our innovative approach to developing the workforce of the future, and one for innovative product development. And Congressman Wu has also visited our site several times in conjunction with our internship program. The grant on creativity and innovation really helped our organization launch into a Workforce of the Future program. And in that program, what we at Climax did is we stood up and we said, it is the responsibility of business to work with the school system and to take responsibility for building that workforce of the future. And we need to really partner with other businesses in the community and get them to come along with us and do this same type of workforce development. And what we found is that the children in school were not able to connect what they were doing in school with what we needed at work. And so we started to partner with the schools and with other businesses, and our program is now on its third session of hosting four groups of 10 interns. And we really focus on life skill development and using many members of the community to help us teach those life skills that the students need no matter who they work for, be it manufacturing or you know, banking or anything else. There's just a certain type of skill set that every employee needs. And in the handout that you have, it outlines other businesses in the area that have been helping us with this approach and also the types of skills that we are teaching these our youth. the other thing that we really like about our program is that it is it's sustainable. We do it in collaboration with other business stakeholders. And we get a sustainable return on investment, which I'll explain to you. It's easily replicated in other communities, but it really incorporates the advanced lean process management training and innovative breakthrough skill upgrades for the workforce, which is something that we really need. We build products that have never been built before and may never be built again, and without that innovation and creativity, we wouldn't have the workforce and be able to sit here in front of you today and tell you, you know, some of the great things that we've been able to accomplish as a company. Burgerville, I'm sure you're all familiar with Burgerville restaurants in Oregon and Washington. They have duplicated their internship program after ours. So again, when I say the life skills that we're giving people, it doesn't matter who they work for or where they work. So who would have thought that a fast food company and a manufacturing company would have been able to join forces to develop skills for the workforce of the future? Burgerville completely replicated their internship program last year after ours. And they hired 12 at-risk youth, 7 of which were hired as full-time employees. And the two groups of interns came together last year. And over the last 3 sessions, our interns have raised over 50,000 pounds of food for the community food bank in Newburgh. So in addition to learning life skills that they need at work, it is expected and it is required as part of their training with us that they do a community project. And so they have to take all of their learned skills that they learn and then apply that back into the community. And we have seen great returns from our students in that. Keith Manufacturing over in Madras, Oregon, has visited us 3 times. They have told us that all of the machine tool technology programs in their high schools over there have been dropped, and they don't know where their workforce of the future is going to come from. So they are coming over, and we'll be working in conjunction with them so that they can replicate our internship program as well. We have many business partners that have been helping us with this, such as Newburgh Ford, the Newburgh Fire Department. We've had financial managers, credit unions, corporate insurance companies. Everyone has come together, and when we talk to people and ask them to come in and help us with this, they are quick to raise their hands and say, I'll do anything I can do to help the workforce of the future grow. In addition, the high schools and the community colleges have stepped up to the plate and have now offer high school credit for our program. So the students get high school credit, and then the community college also said they could get dual credit for our program as well. If they sign up for that credit while they're in high school, the community college credit is actually free. If they actually then end up being an employee of ours, we also offer 100% tuition assistance and encourage them to go on to community college. And we have a great relationship with PCC as well as Chemeketa to continue to drive those college credits for our students. This is I think, a great example of business really stepping up to take responsibility for the workforce of the future in manufacturing, just like Dr. Dewey had just mentioned in nursing. He said, you know, he said, we have to have a program for nursing that is sustainable. Well, we have to have a program in manufacturing that's sustainable as well. Manufacturing is not dead in Oregon. Manufacturing in a lot of areas is doing very well. But we do need the skills of the workforce in order to support that. We recently were awarded a grant of $200,000 from the state of Oregon, and we got that in relationship to a job that we are doing with the Army Corps of Engineers down in Lachlan, Kentucky. The locks on the river have deteriorated, and the locks were actually built by Oregon Iron Works, Oregon Company. And then later, as they needed repairs on those locks, they came to Climax. The Army Corps of Engineers came to Climax and said, can you create a machine that would actually fix these locks? They have a little over $11 billion a year of commerce that goes through those locks, and it's taking them about 2 to 3 months to do the repair on the locks. Our machine will get that repair done for them in about 17 days. So you can see the economic impact that it will have in that area down there. Since it is the Army Corps, of course, it's a competitive bid situation, and we wanted to know if we could get some money from the state to help us support this so that we could be the best bid on the table, not go to the bank for any more loans because that would have compromised our covenants with the bank. The state stepped up and said, we can do that. How much do you think you'll need? We asked for $200,000 for the controls for the system and promised that we would give that $200 control job to yet another Oregon company. We got the job. We gave that bid to the other company, and we won the award for the Army Corps project. When the state asked how we would pay that back, we said we will continue to pay it back through our commitment with the internship program, and we will step forward as a business, and we will continue to share our internship program with other businesses, encourage them to do that, encourage other businesses to help us develop the workforce of the future and create a roadmap that others could easily follow. And we have continued to do that. We were awarded the job. It's actually going to ship the end of this month. The Army Corps is very excited about what we've been able to do for them. And our fourth set of interns start with us in June. And I have heard from teachers, counselors, parents, grandparents, and most importantly, the students themselves, of what an impact our internship has had on them. We have seen interns that did not have their eyes set on college that have now gone to college, picked up and started to get straight A's and are now going to the college of their dreams. I've had grandparents come in and say, I don't know what you've done to my grandson, but he's a different person and has a different outlook. And more importantly, we have also seen a huge impact on what the interns have been able to do for our company. They've helped us improve our safety program. They've helped us improve our marketing. We have probably learned more from our interns than they'll ever learn from us, which is good. If we're going to develop the workforce of the future, we need to know what their needs are and how to best communicate and help train them. So I would invite you to read over the outline that I've given you on our internship or the program. But more importantly, I'd like to let you all know that you have a standing invitation to come out and visit us. Please take us up on that and come and see our program in action and let the interns speak to you about what this has meant to them. Thank you.
So have any of these interns gone on to regular jobs with your company?
Yes, they have. And we have another one that we believe is probably going to be hired after the end of this summer. He will probably start with us on a full-time basis. They have to go through the entire hiring process just like anyone else would, and they have to compete with the outside world again, primarily because they need those skills. They need to learn how to do that. And so, like I say, we've had interns from our program that are full-time employees with us, as well as with other, like Burgerville as well, has done the same thing.
How many employees do you have?
130. 130 here in the United States and 11 over in Germany.
And here, are they all in Newburgh?
Yes. Yes, they are.
It's unfortunate that Senator George, who's a member of this committee, isn't here today. Not only do you have the same name, but you're in his district. So, are you related?
We are not.
No. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Please go ahead.
Grab a microphone here.
Right, just if you'd want to just redirect that. These microphones are very sensitive, so you don't have to. have to get that close.
Hi, I'm Tom Onstead. I'm the owner of Oregon Ballistic Laboratories here in Salem. I want to thank the committee for this opportunity to speak and discuss a little bit how Business Oregon has benefited our company. When the bill was signed in April, it had great relevance to Oregon Ballistic Labs, which I'll refer now as OBL. It helped a small business at a critical time in a bad economy to actually move forward with a contract that we had secured, and I'll explain that a little bit further as I go through here. First, a little background on Oregon Ballistic Labs. My wife and I formed it in 2004, so it's not very old. I've been in the composites industry all my life, well, since I graduated from college, I would say. And created the company because it's just another form of testing of composite materials. I've got a piece of body armor here that I'll talk about a little bit later, but it's made up fully of composite materials. And what we do is test it, make sure that it's safe for our officers and soldiers to wear. We had the intent 6 years ago to actually create the body armor testing lab here in Salem. Why in Salem? It's as good a place as any. My wife grew up here. We wanted to live here. And the key is we wanted to live here. So there is no other ballistic testing laboratory on the West Coast. Everything's from the Mississippi East. So the Pacific Northwest and West Coast is now represented with Oregon Ballistic Labs. Our mission statement of the company is to actually provide ballistic and blast-related testing services for the law enforcement, for DOD and Homeland Security-type sectors. So that's the type of testing we do. I don't want to bore you with the details, but I think it's important you understand where OBL has come in the last 6 years. First of all, we're an ISO 17025 certified testing laboratory with a specialty in testing of ballistic armor. That means we're internationally recognized, and we're one of five in the United States certified to test to the new standard. It's called an NIJ 0101.06 standard. And there's five laboratories in the United States that do that work. And we represent the Department of Justice and perform testing on certified vests. Vests are presented to us to be tested. We go through a testing protocol. We present the data to the Department of Justice. They look at it. If they are happy with the result, they're happy with our test data, they certify us. But if they're happy with that the vest meets its requirement, then that vest gets certified for sale to the 06 standard. A little bit background. In 2003, there was a test done on a body armor that was an 04 standard, and it failed. Actually, the president was wearing it. They took it, tested it as part of the standard. They realized that they had missed something. There's some environmental degradation that was occurring to the composite fibers that were inside, so they revamped the entire standard. We helped create some of that, and we're on the committee, and now we're the recipient of actually testing to that standard. We're one of two certified labs in the United States that test to State Department forced entry ballistic resistant type testing for all windows and doors in U.S. embassies and consulates. We actually test, we create, first we do a ballistic test, we break down we shoot at hinges, door knobs, things like that, and then we go after it with a mob type mentality, create a mob per the standard, and go through some standard equipment, try to bust through it. The significance of that is happened last fall. We were testing a door that actually we failed, had previously been passed. Within 30 minutes, the State Department was informed, and a communique went worldwide to all embassies and consulates that had that door in it and said that we just had a failure here in Oregon. So we take our job pretty seriously. We're certified with the ATF, with a Type 11 FFL, Federal Firearms License, that allows us to buy destructive devices and import destructive devices. We have a Type 10 license, which allows us to manufacture destructive devices. We have a Type 33 license, which is a user of high explosives. Those three test protocols allow us to actually do testing of most of the destructive devices that we're seeing against our troops in Iraq. We do a lot of that testing here in Oregon, most all of it in Oregon, actually up in the coastal range and over in Bend. We have some BLM land that we've leased that we do a lot of our ballistic and blast testing over there, mainly blast. We have a secure facility, secret clearance, so we can do a lot of work for different departments within the federal government. We have CRADAs. A CRADA is a cooperative research and development agreement with the U.S. Navy, and we work with China Lake quite a bit. So another West Coast test facility, but we're doing a lot of work with them. Some of the governments that have come to see us, I'll mention just a few: Canada, Israel, Singapore, Mexico. There's quite a few just governments that have come in. We've had companies from all those companies, as well as Germany, Kuwait, Great Britain, France, and I could certainly go on. Just in the last 2 weeks, we've had a company here from England to do testing, another one from Louisiana, a corporation from Louisiana. We had Nova here filming, Oregon Ballistic Labs doing some filming of a product that I helped develop for a program called Smart Materials later on this year. So we've got some really unique people rolling into the state all because of OBL, sitting here and doing the work we do. Today I'm leaving to go out to the range, and we're doing a test for a company out of Phoenix. So a lot of the companies that we work for aren't Oregon-based, but they certainly bring in a lot of business. So last fall, specifically where Oregon business came in, is we were awarded a contract, a $5 million contract with the U.S. Army Aberdeen Test Center. And that contract requires and asks us to test body armor and helmets for the U.S. military. Just as a point of reference, last week there was 44,000 helmets that were recalled because of poor ballistic performance. That's the type of testing we will go through, make sure, characterize, understand what happened, and create fixes for, or make recommendations for fixes. To do the contract, we had to build two new 15-meter ranges, which we have a campus here in Salem. So we took one of the buildings, modified it, and we built two brand-new ranges to go in there. We made new fixtures. We bought new guns, new chronographs. We hired two new people to actually help get started. The one thing we needed was a device called a FaroArm. It's a device that measures backface deformation using a laser scanning software and hardware device. $180,000. It was a little bit beyond our reach after spending all the money on the other stuff. So Tom Fox and Terry Hegley were very instrumental within the Oregon Department, Oregon business, and presented the concept that we needed some help. Now, Umpqua Bank had been quite a bit of help for us, but because of the limitations of what they're able to do and our limitations as well, we're pretty well, we've been spending as we go. We've been using some of our funds to pay for the previous things I just mentioned. We had a difficult time getting the funding that we needed. So Terry actually was very helpful in working with us, kind of holding our hands through it and putting a proposal up. And so we waited for this bill to be signed that you guys recommended. And so I think we were the first one signed. In fact, when the governor signed it, ours was the first. So again, thank you very much. Here's the update of what's happening. The FaroArm, 7 days after we received the check, the FaroArm arrived here from Florida. It's now here. We're doing training. I'm sending one of our engineers to North Carolina for training. I've got other training happening in 2 weeks. We've got the manufacturer coming here to train two other of our engineers on the techniques for that. And then we have Aberdeen Test Center showing up here the third week in June, and then again the second week in July for formal certification. Once we're done with that, then we start the testing. This new contract is going to allow us to hire 4 to 6 people before the year's end. We've already hired 2, but 4 to 6 more, and these are fairly good. Well, they're good-paying jobs. There's 19 people total on campus here in Salem. We've got 8 different buildings at a facility that we own, of which, let's see, made a note of this, 11 of 19 of those all have bachelor's of science or higher. Oregon Ballistic Labs has 10 people right now. 6 of those 10 have advanced degrees. We have high expectations that this work, the other labs that have already been certified to do this work, are buried in work right now. So I think that what I'm being conservative on the number of people and really excited that we're probably going to be running round-the-clock type testing because the need is out there. There's new body armor certification that needs to be done. Department of Homeland Security has work for us. And then, of course, the U.S. military with these failures that occurred in some of the helmets. We cannot have, you know, bad equipment and safety equipment out there on our troops. It's unacceptable. So we're glad to be part of that. Again, I want to thank the committee for your support of the Senate bill. I definitely want to thank Oregon Business Development Department, Business Oregon, for their efforts in helping us secure these funds for OBL. Director McCabe and Lynn's help, along with Terry and Tom Fox, have been absolutely a joy to work with. The group they represent Oregon, the best of Oregon, in my view. They come in, and they're there to help. They did. It's amazing how the work that we're doing. It struck me when Lynn was speaking of the 4 goals that Oregon Business has. We touch, just because Oregon Ballistic Labs is here and have this work, we're already touching all 4 of those goals. We bring in international business. We have an intern program as well that we created ourselves. That we've got 2 more this summer. Last summer we had 1 from MIT. That we're getting some strange calls from different universities around the nation wanting to come and work with us. So I want to also thank... from behalf of the small businesses in this community, again, for the Oregon business. I think it's a fantastic program, and I encourage you to continue to support it. Lastly, I'd like to invite all of you, if you want to come and see the lab at some point, please give me a call. I'd be happy to give you a tour through the facilities, and we're only 6 blocks away. And trust me, all the guns are pointing the opposite direction. So, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Great.
You might tell about yourself.
Well, thank you. It's great to hear from a Salem business, too.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Lynn mentioned I should mention one of the things that we did develop here in Oregon, and it's a self-sealing, self-healing fuel tank membrane. That's what NOVA was here to test. And there are now thousands of these tankers in Iraq, and now some heading to the other theater with this special coating that was developed right here in Salem and Tigard. And the amazing thing is it was a huge problem in 2004. It's a yawner now because we solved the problem so well. There are some tankers over there. When we started, 1 bullet hole would shut down a 5,000-gallon tanker. And now we've got cases, documented cases, where tankers have been inspected that have in excess of 600 rounds in them, still delivering fuel daily. It's a non-issue. So that's what NOVA was here to see. So
sounds like maybe we should put you to work on the oil refinery leakage problem.
We are actually working on that with the rail industry.
Oh, is that right?
With natural gas, all of
wow.
that. Yes. Yep. If we can stop bullets with just fuel, trying to protect fuel, we can protect a lot of other commodities as well.
Great. So any questions?
Very interesting.
Yes, very interesting.
Yeah, fascinating. Life or death job.
Yes.
I did bring a body armor vest here if you want to feel the weight of it, if I have permission to bring it up to, but or I can pass it around. But it, this thing, it's amazing what these guys have to wear in the field. The vests that are in there, there's been a lot of testing that have had to go and be conducted to make sure that these things don't fail. And I've actually had to wear this thing over there myself, and I brought it back, and so we use that as an example. But the days I was there, it was about 130 degrees Fahrenheit, and it was a little warm. But we take our job very seriously and are very proud to actually help law enforcement as well. We've had Salem PD in. We've had State Highway Patrol in.
Wow.
What does that weigh, 35, 40 pounds?
Something. I think 37 pounds on that one.
And this is only part of their equipment?
It's only part of it, yes, sir. Yeah.
10-pound helmet.
Yeah.
I know you mentioned some numbers, but what did you say your total number of employees are?
We currently have 19 people on
all
campus.
All here in Salem?
All here in Salem, and we're expanding, of course. I project, again, probably 25 by the end of the year, and we're growing. We've doubled in work. In spite of the economy, our work has been, I hate to say it, but given the nature of the world today, I think our business will be busy for quite some time to come.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's tough, the tough aspect of it, but you're obviously feeling the need.
Yes, Senator Telford. Thank you. Lynn, a couple questions, too, regarding Senate Bill 1017. Obviously, it's been somewhat successful. Two questions. One is, most criteria of Oregon business is bankable and profitable. Does this program vary from that, number one? And number two, how much money have we loaned out? I mean, what's the difference in this program versus others, and how much have we actually gotten out into the private sector so far?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, the difference is, I think, as you heard from Johnny, the banks come up against their loan limits, or from Tom as well. And so we do require a rejection on the part of a conventional bank before we enter into it. It isn't that our underwriting is necessarily any less stringent than a conventional lender, but it's what's their limitation on, according to their bank policy, related to how much they can loan to any one borrower, what's the collateralization requirements they have versus ours. That's where the difference is, and in that we can be, I don't want to say liberal, but we can be less stringent and still meet a standard that's acceptable to us. And I'll let John Saris, who's here, runs the program, tell you how many dollars we've loaned. But you provided us, I think, a capital infusion of $5 million, and it's spoken for. You know, two months after the infusion, it's spoken for. Mm-hmm. Chair, with your indulgence, I just want to reiterate a couple points that were made. Certainly, we've retouched again on the whole idea of availability of capital and how important that is. The other thing that Tim McCabe at every presentation emphasizes is the necessity of our staff. And it's the connections between our staff, Tom Fox, as was mentioned, Terry Hagley as well in the department. It's a connection between staff in the field that know a situation and can match resources with a situation that makes things happen for businesses. The other thing I want to emphasize is that when we do make an investment, we gauge very clearly as part of our evaluation criteria how many jobs are going to be created, how much income tax, personal income tax, is going to be generated by those jobs, and what's it going to do for the state of Oregon and benefit. We're frankly in the business to make the state money, and by creating jobs and income tax. It's simple as that. That's one of the measures that we use when we make a strategic reserve investment, when we make a loan. That's just how we approach it.
Great. So you've got it.
Yep,
the answer.
I'm good.
Right. Great. Okay. I wanted to ask you, too, so we did try to make the loan program a little easier to access, and obviously since the funds you said are all spoken for, I assume it's working. Are there, but can you address how many of those applicants might not have qualified before?
Chairman, I'm not sure about the criteria of not, might not qualified, wouldn't have qualified because we didn't have any money, clearly.
Right.
But then having the money available and using the criteria, which is still sound and high, but just having the capital available.
Right.
So all of them, absent the money.
Okay. Great. Okay, well, I don't see any other questions, so thank you very much. This has been really interesting, and seeing some of the examples of businesses that are benefiting from your services even more so. So, okay, well, members, I think that completes everything on our agenda for today. If you have ideas for our future hearings, we have two more left in the interim. It would be great to get them to me or to Teresa, and we will try to work them into the schedule. Our next meeting is
not until September,
so there's some time to think about what you would like to work on. So, with nothing further to come before us, members, we are adjourned. And...